few of you who don't know, this week is Living Wage Week, which is a celebration across the country to raise awareness for the living wage and celebrate employers and campaigns who are campaigning for it. And here in Oxford, we have organised this talk to raise awareness and like contribute a little bit for that. So thank you all for coming. So I don't know if any of you saw an update on Sunday, which is that the living wage went up. It changes every year, so now it went up from 7.85 to 8.25 across the UK. So that means all of the organisations that have accredited as living wage employers will now start paying that amount. So we are living in Oxford at the moment, and as the talk suggested and told you, Oxford is currently the least affordable place to live in the UK. So at the moment this is an incredibly pertinent issue and one that really involves us as students living in Oxford City. So we have three speakers here who are going to talk to us and discuss this, and I just invite them to introduce themselves because I think that would probably be best. So who are, like, what your involvement or interest with the living wage is would be great. Thank you.
I'm Danny Dorling. I'm from St Peter's College and the Geography Department. I've been involved with the people who try to work out how to calculate the living wage for many years, and I've been interested to see how the students have managed to win it in the university here. It was very nice coming to this university 2 years ago and actually finding a successful student campaign that was tipping over college after college. There's still a little bit way to go, but it's over halfway there. So well done.
I'm Emma Cosman. I'm from the Living Wage Foundation, so I work day to day with employers, helping them to pay the living wage, understand what that means, and then celebrating them when they do go living wage. And I've also been really delighted to see the progress in Oxford. Congratulations to the Student Union on becoming the Champion Award winner for the region, which is really fantastic news. I didn't have a say in the voting at all, totally independent, so I didn't rig it, but I would rig it for you if I could.
I'm Vlad Coulter. I'm a city councillor here in Oxford. I came here to study economics at Ruskin College, just up in Headington. Before I graduated, I was elected to represent one of the poorest areas of the city, Barton Sandhills. I've been involved with living wage for quite some time because inherently it is just the right thing to do. As an active trade unionist, I give talks across the country to try to encourage employers, particularly small and medium enterprises, to pay the living wage. I gave a presentation to Oxford University Health Trust. This is the provider of healthcare within our city, and it employs 1,100 people who are being paid below the Oxford living wage. I do have to make a distinction in that because of the absurdly high housing costs in Oxford, we have broken away from the national rate and we track the London rate. We pay 95% of the London rate and recognise that as the Oxford living wage. So with the London living wage going up, the new rate for the Oxford living wage is £8.93 an hour, so significantly more than the £8.25 an hour for the national living wage.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure we'll come back to all of these issues later. So just a glimpse in how we're going to organise this. We're going to have four sections, kind of four questions that we're going to work from, and we're going to open up to the audience for questions after those four sections. So if you've got anything to ask, there will be a chance throughout, and then we can have general questions at the end. And I didn't introduce myself. I'm Henry, one of the new co-chairs of the Oxford Living Wage Campaign, and the other one is Claire, who's sitting at the back there. So just to go straight into it, our first question, which is going to start with Emma, is just to explain what the living wage is and why it's so important.
Fantastic. How long can I have?
5 minutes would be great.
Okay, well, I think I'm down to a neat 5 minutes, but cut me off if anyone glazes over. So I'm Emma, I'm from the Living Wage Foundation, and just wanted to start off by saying thank you so much for coordinating this talk, and happy Living Wage Week. Also just wanted to say that it's really exciting to be on this panel, and definitely really wonderful to have you both here, Thanks so much to the council for all of your leadership on the living wage. So Oxford City Council was one of the first local authorities to become living wage accredited, and did it in a really brilliant way without going into the detail of too much procurement too early on into the night. We often get calls saying we'd like to do in Oxford, which is obviously wonderful to see. So the Living Wage Foundation, if you haven't come across us before, we offer an accreditation badge. So it's based on fair trade, and we award it to employers who do two things. The first is to commit to pay the living wage to their directly employed staff, and the second is to put a plan in place for putting the living wage in through their subcontracted staff who are working on site regularly. We also provide a forum for employers and civil society leaders to come together and champion responsible pay. The roots of the campaign are from Citizens UK, which is our parent charity. That's an organisation that practices community organising. So the idea is you bring together communities, so faith groups, trade unions, local organisations, anywhere you go and you join voluntarily as a person in your community. And the idea is that you join campaigns not just as an individual, but as a community. So everybody is supported and you're speaking for the whole group of people. And the Living Wage first came up in 2001 from communities who were working in and around Canary Wharf. So people who were cleaning, catering, and working in security, who can, in the ring around Canary Wharf, I don't know if people have been there, but you can sort of, you can see well, but you can't quite touch it. And it was people who were working 2-3 jobs and basically missing out on family life. Just, you know, leaving while the kids are in bed and coming home and their kids are still in bed, and they were, you know, missing seeing their children grow up. They started campaigning and asking employers one by one to come on board, which works, but then you have to go back each year to ask them to uprate, which is quite time consuming. And one of the things that worked really well with getting employers to stay on board and keep uprating, keep making sure that the cleaners are included as well, was a little tradition that we came up with, which was giving a garland of flowers to put that around the chief executive's neck publicly or around the council leader's neck to say thank you. And we found that saying thank you really worked, and people like to be congratulated and to be praised for doing something good. So that's where the idea of having a fair trade mark, a mark where you say congratulations and thank you, that employers can use in their branding, really came from. So there's now 2,000 accredited organisations. We announced that yesterday. We've doubled in a year. So there were 1,000 in Living Wage Week last year. And you may have seen some announcements. So Unilever, Lloyds, PG Tips are Living Wage now, which is huge for the Living Wage consumer movement. So the UK rate now is £8.25 and the London rate is £9.40. And just looking back to sort of the last phase of the campaign, so last year, this time during Living Wage Week, we were making the case that there were too many workers on the national minimum wage and that there was a need for a higher voluntary rate to start pushing people up the pay scale. And while we may not have felt like it last year, it does turn out that people were listening, particularly George Osborne. In July this year, they announced a national living wage in the budget. So that is, in effect, a higher minimum wage, which applies to over 25s. It will come in from next April at £7.20. And the goal is to reach 60% of median income, which is projected to be just above £9. So we really welcome this move. It takes 6 million people out of poverty. And these clever economists are informing me that we've made a small impact on the gender pay gap. Not an economist. So we do really welcome that, but we do argue that there's still a need for a higher rate that employers adopt on a voluntary basis and that has a link to a basket of goods and services, so has a link to the actual cost of living, in order to push wages up, but also for employers to understand where they are in relation to that cost of living figure. There are a few questions outstanding, so the impact of tax credit changes on the rate. We're waiting for the autumn statement at the end of this month to understand any transitional measures and exactly what that's going to mean. And of course, finally, there is a lot of confusion around the words living wage. So if you build up a voluntary movement around the words living wage, that this is something that responsible employers going above and beyond do, then there's some confusion caused when you name the national minimum wage the living wage, which has meant that just practically at the Living Wage Foundation, we're a really small charity and the phones have been ringing off the hook, and we're just needing to upskill ourselves in how we advise workers and route people through to HMRC and the right agencies. So the next steps is making sure more organisations become accredited, breaking into new sectors. So you will have seen the first supermarkets announcing that they're pegging to the living wage rate, which is really phenomenal, and we didn't think would happen this year, but it has. So new and different schemes, so innovating and understanding other options just beyond accreditation that work to crack into different sectors. And also building a consumer movement, so helping the organisations that have gone above and beyond and said that they will be a living wage, helping to funnel business through to them. So we've launched an interactive map today. If you go to livingwagepeoplesmovement.org, you can see who's accredited near you. So you can search by postcode or service and make sure that you're supporting those organisations. You can also download different resources, calling cards to reach out to employers. So if you're interested in a little bit of homework and you'd like to help the living wage movement, one thing you might like to do as a group is write out to different organisations or take in calling cards, leaflets, and encourage them to go living wage.
Lovely, thank you. And just to talk to the others, so what is the living wage and why it's important? If anyone could tell us about how it's calculated would be useful. Danny?
Have a go about how it's calculated. It's calculated in a consensual way. So the researchers at the University of Loughborough have for years got groups of people together, people chosen at random together, and they've gone through a basket of goods. What kind of clothes should you be able to have? What items should you be able to afford to eat? And they spent hours with people going through a list asking what's reasonable. It's really basic. It's what you need to live off. It's not any kind of luxury. They work it out for different groups of people, people with children, people without children, and so on, but they come up with one figure for the wage. They also work it out for pensioners. And my favourite example to try to explain how frugal this thing is that recently these groups decided that it was okay for a pensioner to be able to have a pension that would allow them to buy a bird feeder, but not okay for the living wage and living pension, in effect, to be high enough for them to put grain in that bird feeder. The grain is discretionary. If you want to put food and feed the birds, you should eat less. But it's good for old people to have a bird feeder because you can get very lonely. So that's how, you know, that's how knife edge it is. There's nothing, it is in a way back to Victorian times and when Joseph Rowntree's son Seaborn Rowntree produced the first family budgets around about 1901, when he did the very radical thing. He worked out how much food you needed. He said you didn't need any drink. He didn't like pubs and alcohol. He did include chocolate, but that's because his dad ran the biggest chocolate factory in York. But he also said, along with these subsistence items, you should be able to afford a stamp to send a letter to a loved one. And that was seen as too far at the time, that people don't need that. And in a way, these kind of items are being included. Now the equivalent item to the stamp, if you've got small children, is being able to run a very cheap car, because it's very hard if you've got small children to not be able to run a third or fourth hand car. So those are the kind of items that are included. But it's done carefully. It's upgraded every year. We have a separate one for London. We don't yet have an official one for Oxford and Brighton and other areas, but it's moving us towards the idea of a minimally acceptable standard to eventually change the minimum wage to the living wage. I think we have to call it the real living wage for a bit.
Yes.
Well, George Osborne decides to call his one the living wage. But the key thing is how fast we've come in such a short time. Around about 1997, Van will know better, 98, every single Conservative MP voted against the minimum wage, much, much lower wage. Mm-hmm. And in less than 10 years, you've moved to a position where hundreds of companies are happy to pay, were explained, persuaded, and then agreed to pay a higher one. And the Conservative Chancellor leading a party who hopes to be the leader of that party puts into... Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And if you just think, well, what would it take to move forward as fast again in the next 10 years, and where would you get to? I don't think it's unrealistic to say that we're on the edge of a turn in how we treat people and how we think about different people in our society, from the way we did think about them in 1995, 96, when people at the bottom were just thought as disposable. Didn't matter what you paid them. You know, if they couldn't command it in the market, they should just suffer. That really was the attitude back in the 1990s.
Great. And Van, if you've got anything to add to that?
Well, to me it's nothing new, because we have the wages boards, which were established in 1909. And they covered quite a wide range of industries. So every particular sector had a national body who met with representatives of the employers. And they thrashed out what hairdressers might be paid, what any tradesperson should be paid as a basic minimum, what agricultural workers should be paid. Slowly, they were abolished, with the last one being abolished in 1992, the Agricultural Wages Boards. And since then, we've seen real pay deteriorating, and those people who are working in agriculture are on such a pittance now. And yet, food supply is a national necessity. We have to have fit workers in that industry, but how can they be fit if they're on a poverty wage? Some of the statistics I looked out to do with malnutrition. Since 2010, where it is the primary or secondary reason for admission to hospital, it's gone up by 71%. These are Victorian diseases that are revisiting us. Rickets. Scurvy. How can you expect people in the 21st century to be suffering from scurvy? But the fact is that there are a lot of people who are working, can't afford to eat decently because they're not being paid decent wages. I think it's important for me to explain that although we have a policy within Oxford City Council for a living wage, and although we benchmark it at £8.93 now, not one single worker in Oxford City Council gets that rate of pay, because the absolute minimum under our negotiated pay agreement with the trade unions is £9.21. But we set that benchmark as an example to all the other businesses in Oxford, and we are trying to persuade them to take on board that decency and to respect the fact that if they treat their employees with decency, their employees will then reciprocate that. If you think of it, if you're on poverty pay and you're worried about how to pay the rent, you'll be looking for better paid employment. What degree of loyalty will you have for someone who's not paying you an appropriate amount? Whereas, if the employer does recognise I have to pay this minimum threshold, that can actually establish loyalty and a willingness and enthusiasm to work for that particular employer. So whenever I describe living wages, I get representatives from these small and medium enterprises, the local CBI, and they wholeheartedly agree with the concept of a living wage. The difficulty they have is, I can't pay first, because then I'll be outcompeted This is why I call upon government to introduce a real living wage based on the needs of workers, of individuals. So we just come back to the Oxford Living Wage. There's three elements to it. We guarantee that no one working directly for the council will earn less. We also guarantee that where someone does business for us, such as currently in my ward, we've got Blackwell Construction preparing the infrastructure for a new housing estate, and Lang O'Rourke, who are installing the sewers, all their basic workers who would be on the national minimum wage are being paid the Oxford Living Wage. And that's more than £2 an hour difference. So we've got Fusion Leisure, which is our partner to deliver sports and recreation. As soon as we insisted that they pay the living wage, the pay of the cleaners went up by a third. Can you think of what difference that made to those households? And also, every one of those cleaners was female. So that does make a difference between gender pay inequality.
Okay, I'm just going to stop you there because I'm aware we're running out of time and we'd probably like to move on to Oxford as a focus of our talk. So we're going to, if anyone's got any questions at this point about the living wage and why it's important, and if not, we can move on. Yeah?
It was just one question. So the number of employees which are accredited has doubled from 1,000 to 2,000 last year. Do you think that's due to a greater awareness of public pressure, or do you think it's due to needs? And you know, the rise of food banks, etc., it's being driven by needs rather than public pressure. Which of the two do you think?
I think probably both. I think that the model is working quite well, whereby as each accredited employer gets the badge, they're able to celebrate, do a little blog from the chief executive, do a little press release, and then that spirals. So we try to have as many firsts as we can. I was just saying that we've had our first living wage dairy.
There's the ripple effect. So if you get someone like Oxford City Council saying, we'll be a living wage employer, then pop, 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 like a rash, other living wage employers become established.
The Living Wage Employer Network is much like a rash. So in Oxford, there are 17 accredited living wage organisations, including six colleges, the student union, the university itself, and the council, a range of other charities, and you've got a really great bunch. We've also got a recognised service provider cleaning company, which is a new badge that we have set up, and those companies commit to every time they go for a new piece of work, they give one price at the market rate and one price at the living wage rate, which is really exciting because any time you are going for a new piece of work and looking at getting a contract in, you can see transparently what that will mean for the cost of your contract and exactly how much is more is going to the staff. So most of the big cleaning companies have now committed to doing this, and it's really changed the market. I think it's quite an exciting new scheme and helping to just debug some of those myths that are coming up quite a lot. And there are some specific Oxford myths, I will say, having been on the phone to different employers calling up.
Yeah. I mean, one problem we have is that only half a dozen colleges have accredited. So the majority of the rest are paying it, but they're not accredited. Which partly means that they do not know it's just gone up. Mm. So if you want to do one thing, send a little email to the head of your college just saying, thank you for paying the living wage. By the way, do you know it's gone up to this? And later on, if they get back to you, I'd say, by the way, do you know the Oxford City Council have a higher one? They'll be slightly embarrassed if you do send an email saying thank you for paying living wage, if it so happens what yours is one of the colleges that doesn't. But that's the way I would do it to begin with. They do not know it's gone up. The majority do not know it's gone up because they're not accredited, so they do not get the information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else? Yeah?
As you sort of off the back of what you two guys were saying, it might be useful for everyone in the room to just name the six colleges that are accredited.
Okay, are you ready? St Hilda's College, Christchurch College, Somerville College, Wadham, Mansfield, Hartford, and the Student Union and the university itself. And a supplier of merchandise, and they specialise in university jumpers and t-shirts. By the way, Shirt Works. Little shout out if you're going to get any Living Wage Oxford merch printed up.
Please. Any other questions at this point? Okay, well, we'll move on to the second section, which is talking about why wage inequality is such a pertinent issue in Oxford City, and what factors are causing that. And we're going to start with Danny, if that's okay.
Okay. The kind of reasons why this matters for people. It can seem like a terribly small amount of money, a couple of pounds more an hour. Often it's people who are just working 20 or less hours a week who are getting this because they're part-time. So you might be talking about just £500 a year to the people who are affected. The reason why it matters isn't just because people will actually do a better job for you and everything else. It's the effects on the lives of people of getting £500 more a year. Oxford has five secondary state schools. One of those schools ranks in the bottom 25 of all secondary schools in the whole of England for GCSE results. The other 24 schools, which are in that bottom 25, tend to be in very poor areas of the country. Oxford is not a poor area of the country, and the fact that one of its schools does so badly is a shame to Oxford. The university do numerous things in the area of this school. They send out researchers, they try to help and so on. But the most effective thing that the university has done recently in the colleges is to start paying the living wage. Because the majority of parents work of the children in that school, but they were on the minimum wage. Once they're on the living wage, £500 extra a year gives you enough money to buy your kid a second-hand computer. If you do not have a second-hand computer, you'll know this. I mean, most of you did GCSEs in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, I'm guessing. Okay, if you try and do that, sorry for those a bit older. Yeah, trying to do your GCSEs and then your BTEC or A-level without a computer at home, without access to the internet, having to go to that special room in the school for the poor kids to do their homework on the school computers is tricky. And I can give numerous examples, and people going hungry is incredibly important. But the university was making part of Oxford do very, very badly at education because it was so stingy about how much it would pay some of its employees. And it's slowly working out that it shouldn't do that. Academics are not as clever as you might think. That's the other thing, just well worth saying. Yeah, they often do not get the importance of paying this. So it does require help from students. And it just slips below their radar. They think, oh, that's something we did in governing body 1 year. They won't notice that it's going. So you are going to have to help them and push it a little bit. But once a governing body pays living wage, it makes it possible for people on that governing body of a college to then suggest other things that you might do because you're decent people. And you wouldn't believe how hard it often is to suggest doing things you might do because you're decent people on the governing body of a college. So you are helping the academics if you do push for this, let alone actually helping people in the rest of Oxford. But you've got to remember, you have control of the employees. I mean, one other thing to say is not far away, there are incredible things going on. The University of Reading largely staffs its campus using its own students. And it pays its own students, I think, only just over £5 an hour because they're under 21. Mm-hmm. So you're paying £9,000 a year for the privilege of going to University of Reading, which will then employ you at just over £5 an hour to sit behind a till in a shop in Reading serving other students. The students of Reading need a little bit of help to get a living wage campaign going, which would actually directly benefit them themselves. So there's a lot more to be done, and it helps people across the social scale. It's not just in the poorest part of town, it's students working behind the bars in some of the richest part of town. And of course you know which students it will be who will work behind the bar more than others. Yeah, because you're very good at hiding your wealth and income, but some people need money more than others, and you'd much rather your friends working one less hour behind the bar than an extra hour because the pay rate is so low.
Okay. Van, if you've got anything to add to that on why wage equality is such a pertinent issue in Oxford City.
I've got copies of leaflets people can help themselves to. They set out a lot of the granular detail about the poverty in Oxford. 25% of all the children live in poverty in Oxford. There are 24 wards, and there are 7 wards in which over half of all the children in those wards are being raised in poverty. One of the effects of being on poverty pay is that you cannot sustain your tenancy, particularly in a city as buoyant as Oxford, where landlords can get someone who'll pay a higher rent than you will. So in my ward, in the last week, I've had 3 people contacting me saying their landlord is not renewing their tenancy because it's going to a professional. That puts that family in crisis. What happens to the children when they move? They have to move school. What happens to the child's education? It becomes disrupted. It's no surprise that for the 16-year-old boys leaving school in Oxford, 24% leave with no GCSEs whatsoever. What chance do they have in the employment market? And with the cuts being made now to further education, they're going to find it so difficult to get a second chance. Life expectancy. I watched a little snippet that the City Council put out on Facebook yesterday. The difference in life expectancy between one ward and the next is 14 years. If you are on poverty pay, if you live in a poor ward, you'll die 14 years before someone living in a rich part of Oxford. To me, that is the ultimate inequality. And it comes back to people just not having enough to sustain themselves. It's indecent.
And Emma, if you've got anything to add on.
I would echo all of those points. I think I'm pretty new to Oxford, so I'm learning from all of you. I've had a lovely tour from the City Council, which was very nice. But it strikes me that there's a lot of poverty right next to a lot of wealth. So I work across the country. So I'm the programme manager for employers in Wales, in the northeast, in the southeast. And it's cities like this where there's a lot of high wages, and it seems that there's a lot of very successful businesses, a lot of iconic businesses that should be able to accredit relatively easily and should be able to sign up. And I feel that our task is to make those businesses understand that they have a responsibility for their subcontractors, and they may not. It's just a bit of a journey to make people understand that actually you do have a responsibility for the cleaners, and you have a responsibility for low-paid workers, even if they're on your bill. And frankly, only 18 accredited employers is not great. I think we could be doing a lot better. I think, you know, if we were to, you know, if everyone here was to try and nudge one business along, then we could be here next year and have, you know, quadrupled the network. I said before, I'm not a maths person, but I think that would be a really lovely target. I think, you know, it's always great to, you know, come here and basically say, yes, we all agree, you know, working poverty is bad, but what's really fantastic for me about this is that we can actually do something, you know, even if it's just a few people's pay and we're just doing it employer by employer by employer, then that does create a bigger movement. And you know, perhaps even if we just decided to write to 100 companies together as a group, then that might be an exciting mm-hmm. thing to do. Just to share a story that I heard of somebody in low pay yesterday, who was a mum who had two little boys. She'd been on low pay for a really long time, and she had had her children during that time, and talked about taking them around the shops. So she'd started off shopping in Asda, and it got too expensive, and then she'd been shopping in Lidl. And just as prices were going up, she was only able to get the essentials, and she talked about how when you have children, they want things, and just going through the aisles with the trolley and them wanting to put things in and then going down from a trolley to a basket, and what it meant for her to get the living wage from through the accreditation process. So it wasn't a decision her employer made, it was a decision made at arm's length by the company that subcontracts her employer. She said it came from nowhere, it came from the heavens, and that like the difference that she'll have from last Christmas to this Christmas of just being able to get her kids treats, and that was really lovely. I think we know and we understand the impact that this has for families, but just to sort of broaden out what that means, that's not just that family, it's that community. So it's that person maybe going down from working three jobs to working two jobs, you know, having a bit more time to volunteer, you know, train up, do the church garden, you know, take on doing a club, become a school counsellor, whatever it might mean, just to have a little bit more time to give something back. I think ultimately this movement is about how we value time and how we value people. So in hospitality it comes up a lot. Talking to people who work in football stadiums and say that, you know, at the end of my shift there was this this lobster left over, and it was valued at four times as much as I was paid for the shift that I was working, and how that makes people feel. And just further on from families, communities, there's also local businesses. So the type of people who are going to have the pay increase, who are going to go from minimum wage to living wage, more likely to spend that money locally. So there is a real benefit there. Been some interesting articles around the link between the living wage and the environmental movement coming out this week. So do check that out. Friends of the Earth have been doing a bit of work, which has been really exciting. I think that's all from me.
Lovely, thank you. Are there any questions at this point? No? Okay, well, we'll move on then to ask Emma about what has been done. We've spoken about this already, but in Oxford so far, in terms of like the colleges and how that's kind of affected things, if you've got anything to say on that.
Fantastic. Well, I know that one of my colleagues is a former president of the student union, and he said that on the day that the University of Oxford got accredited, he worked out the timings, and that he had been 10 years ago on that day, he'd been in a room talking about the living wage. So sometimes this does take a little bit, it takes some time, and it means students handing this down to the next generation. Really fantastic leadership, and again, just congratulations on being the Champion Award winner for the year, and great to see so much more movement. Obviously, reaching out to the colleges is going very well, and fantastic that you've coordinated this forum, and I'm excited to learn more about your plans and also the plans of the council.
Danny, if you've got anything to say about the progress in Oxford so far?
It's at a peak. College after college went last term. Nobody wanted to be the one left looking stupid. Academics hate looking stupid. So it's kind of great time. The worry is that it'll go quiet. The university suggested four options for colleges. It kind of held our hands. Option one was to actually become a proper living wage accredited employer, which half a dozen did. There were options two, three, and four. Four meant you actually did pay it, kind of grudgingly and a little bit late, but you did. It is going to require a little bit more push to make sure that the uprating is paid. And be polite, be thankful. I don't think there's a need to be that confrontational now because of the role, not yet. But a college that managed to accredit itself and a college that's actually paying it looks well managed. If a college is managing to pay it, then you don't have to feel quite so bad. I'd still be really annoyed, but not quite so bad that they're charging you £9,000 a year. But if they're charging you £9,000 a year and they can't quite pay it on time, you know, you've got to ask, what are you paying your £9,000 a year for? And if they're phoning up alumni and asking them to give thousands of pounds to the college as a charity, and this charity cannot even pay its workers this because it can't organise itself so much, why on earth should anybody give any money to it as a charity? There are other charities in the world that may appear, you know, you've got to be careful about it. I would go not for confrontational, but for encouragement. But just check that your college is still paying it, knows it's gone up, has processes in play to do that, because it would just be so embarrassing to begin to lose it now out of ineptitude. And it's unlikely, but I'm afraid it'll be the students more than the tutors that actually manage to keep it up on the agenda. And then at some point, I think the centre of the university will actually do your job, and we'll just send people notices around telling them it's gone up to this now. And you never know, you know, we might actually manage to be as good as the city council. But growing up in Oxford, I'd never thought the university was as good as the city council.
Yeah, on the back of that, to kind of carry on from there, asking to Van, about what's been done in Oxford, but also how we can continue to campaign for the living wage in Oxford, and what's the best way to go about that?
I think social movement campaigning has great strengths. Galvanising the energy of communities, of individuals. If you look at the 38 Degrees campaign regarding tipping, where in certain establishments, just simply because you have dispensed such a value of meals in that evening, the employer deducts an amount from your salary on the assumption you must have got a tip. So there are plenty of establishments in Oxford that have that practice whereby their staff don't even get to see the full pay packet because the employer is assuming you've served £200 worth of food tonight, so you must have got at least 20 quid in tips. If I look at one sector, the care sector, very important for us all. We get ill. There are 307,000 care workers in Britain who are currently on zero-hour contracts. They're not even paid the national minimum wage because they're not paid for travel time between one client and the next. I understand there's going to be some legislation on that particular practice. But as soon as one of their clients goes into hospital, guess what happens to the care workers' wages? It falls off a cliff because they've got no guaranteed hours. So along with backing the living wage, we must also be campaigning for guaranteed hours of work. And a third element to make the living wage work is access to affordable housing. This is a whole different subject, but what the government are doing to affordable housing is absolutely atrocious. We've got a situation whereby we had a pot of money we were reserving to build 1,000 new council houses in Oxford, and the government have pulled the rug. They're now not allowing us to increase rents in line with inflation. Instead, we've got to reduce them. And the difference between that increase we're denied and the reduction we have to make will cost us £36 million over the next 4 years. We were looking to establish a pot of £121 million to build 1,000 new council houses. Now, very fortunately, in my ward, we've already started to build 354 new council houses. The next big threat is right to buy. And I've got two houses side by side One's still a council house, brought up to decent home standard, new roof, externally clad to improve the thermal efficiency of the building. Next door is a private tenancy now, following it right to buy when the tenant owner moved on, private landlord. Not in any way decent home standards. But guess what? It's got three times the rent of the decent home next door. The decent home, 110 quid a week to rent. This one, 295. And where's the housing benefit going that the tenant receives? It doesn't go to the tenant, it goes to the landlord, who's doing bugger all. So there are three things we've got to do. Decent pay, access to affordable housing, and guaranteed hours.
Lovely, thank you. And Emma, if you'd like to talk, and particularly maybe a response to the idea of the Oxford Living Wage.
Fantastic. I'll do that first.
Yeah.
So we obviously really welcome any movement to push wages up, is clearly something that we all agree on. I'm making assumptions about you all. You're in this room. I'm thinking that you like the idea of workers being paid more. When we launched the Living Wage Foundation in 2011, we took advice from a number of international partners who'd been doing living wage campaigns for a long time. Particularly, we spoke to people in the States, where there are lots of different living wage rates for lots of different cities within states. And the one piece of advice that's really been given to us internationally is just have one rate. If you really want employers to take you seriously, so not just local employers, but you want employers that are UK-wide, the first thing they'll say is, it's too complicated, I've got to work out all these different rates through my pay scale, and they'll just walk away. And employers will take any excuse to just leave it. So we've tried to maintain that, so having one rate for the whole of the UK, and we do have one separate rate for the capital, which really comes out of the formal London weighting. So lots of employers will already have a higher rate that they pay for London or for employees within the London area. And we think that while it's really fantastic, while the City Council has done just incredible, phenomenal work and shown really brilliant leadership, we think that what's best, when we've spoken before, is to have a kind of two-tiered approach. So what we'd like to do is start reaching out to employers around the UK rate and try not to confuse people too much so that people understand what a living wage rate is. I mean, when I talk to employers who aren't totally focused around social justice, and many of them aren't, they want it to be simple. They want it to take less than 10 minutes. They want their boss to like it, and they just want you to go away. They don't want to have to figure out what these four different rates are. It's already very confusing, and particularly increasingly confusing with the new government announcement to help people understand what a living wage is. That said, it's really important that we're a movement that represents what's happening in the economy. I think there is a case to be made that Oxford's a really expensive city, and that should be looked at really closely. I don't have the jurisdiction, I'm not the decision maker on this. It would be the Living Wage Advisory Council, which is made up of different large employers, the Trade Union Congress, many bigger charities, the Resolution Foundation, Save the Children, who would really look at the detail of it, and I think would make a really balanced decision and want to talk to local partners. I mean, ultimately, yeah, if Oxford is becoming as expensive as London to live in, and employers are recognising that, then that's something that we would absolutely want to adapt to, because this is about having a pragmatic movement where employers can act now and make change before, and in the hope that other agencies will join us in that. Just thinking a little bit about reaching out to employers, and I just wanted to just think about where you're powerful. So if you are thinking about approaching a employer and encouraging them to go living wage, definitely your college, any other institutions that you go to and you're a customer, so like your hairdresser, right, your gym, Anywhere that you can say, I love going here, we've already got a relationship, I'm your customer, I'd love it even more if you were to pay the living wage. But also just thinking about you as a network, you are powerful reaching out to businesses that are based in Oxford and who are interested in the student market, right? So bookshops, stationery shops, pubs, cafes. It just might be worth thinking a little bit about who you have power over and who's going to listen to you if you ask them to pay the living wage. So, you know, absolutely, as a coordinated people's movement, we'll be doing 3 days of action next year. So on the big supermarkets, it'll be, you know, so we'll be having teams go out to each, you know, representing the living wage movement in each city. It'd be wonderful to have you guys join us on that. But just for kind of local action, if you're reaching out to people, just thinking about where you can have the best impact.
Thank you. And Danny, if you've got anything to add to that?
No, I was mischievously thinking if we applied to be the 34th borough of London, we could. And you'd never have to talk to the county councillors again. We'll do that. Certainly bookshops, that one on Broad Street. It's worth asking them again if they can afford, if one of the family associated with the ownership of that bookshop can afford to be one of UKIP's biggest donors. They have enough money to pay the living wage, and they say they don't, and Amazon outbids them. Let's just put it that way. It all gets a bit tricky, but you do have to push it. And this spans across people. I met a group of students from Oxford Brookes recently who are each paying at least £600 a month. They've only just arrived in Oxford. £20 a night for accommodation in the city. Their landlords will not be paying anything like £20 a night to provide them with that accommodation. People are being ripped off. You will be ripped off in 3, 4, 5 years' time when you're renting, a majority of you in London. And it's going to happen to you as well. And I think what this campaign is part of a larger campaign about saying people have to be treated decently, they don't have to be ripped off, we don't have to be a society in which a few people are enriching themselves so much to the detriment of so many other people. We've become like that and it's time to move away from it. That's what's happening. It's going to require constant push, effort, a bit of an embarrassment, and a bit of saying, no, it's not good enough. You can behave better than this. And you'd be amazed how many people who are quite greedy become a little bit less greedy. The number of absolutely psychotic, greedy people with no feelings whatsoever in society is remarkably small. But there are a lot of people who've got used to the idea that they should have a lot. And it's okay to pay other people very little, and it's okay to charge whatever the market will bear to their tenants. And that won't change unless you begin demanding changing, and you do have more power than the average person has. I don't quite believe what Tristan Hunt said in Cambridge last week, but you do have to recognise that you are already more powerful individuals than average, you will be more powerful than average. It just adds a little bit to the guilt and the reason why you have to do it. It is easier to do it. The same kind of confidence that got you here can get you other things and can get other people other things.
Thank you. Has anyone got any questions? Yeah?
I was wondering about the distinction in the minimum wage between under 21s and over 21s. Because you were saying in your research that you distinguish between people with families and people without families. And do you think that would be a much more effective way of looking at that?
I'd start to look at that. I mean, people used to have, some still do. In my mum's generation, everybody had their kids around 21, 22. The Queen had her first kids around 21, 22. This government are changing regulations to make it so that you can't leave home until you're over 25. 35 to be able to actually be on your own somewhere, yes, and get housing benefit. But no claiming of anything. So they're infantilising you. Unless you're from such a wealthy background that your parents can completely support you. It's a very nasty attitude. Why somebody should be paid just £5 an hour because they're 18 or 19 working behind a till is simply wrong. And it's the reason we do pay people less because they're that young is because you haven't learned to organise when you're that young. Yeah. You're naive. And that's why we do it. But yeah, it's time to change that.
Go on. Just feeding on from that. I have a health condition and I recently applied for help with health costs. And I'd gone from being at university where I didn't have an income, so I didn't pay for health costs, to paying what would be, if I didn't have the prescription card, nearly £70 a month in prescriptions.
Yes.
And I applied for health costs to the government, DWP, and they came back and it said, we can't give you help with health costs because we say that you need £67 a week to live off. And based on your income, you earn X amount over that per week. Mm. And I rang them up and I spoke to them and said, you know, why are you saying that I need £67 to live off? And it said that there was a disability premium of, say, £10 per week.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, it's based on your age.
Yes.
And again, I just wonder, you know, how can you
do
say,
that?
Oh, you're 23, yeah. So, you know.
No, it's amazing we got to this situation. The poorest fifth of people in this country are the poorest fifth in the whole of Western Europe. You know, we do things that similar countries wouldn't allow and things that we did not used to do. I can remember this city with hardly anybody homeless. There were a few old men homeless. And then we suddenly withdrew housing benefit from 16 and 17-year-olds. This was in the 80s.
Yes.
And that's the first time you saw 16 and 17-year-olds on the street. There's a long way to go, but use the enthusiasm of things that have been won to make it better. And this happened before. Those trade councils that came in and so on, they didn't just happen out of nowhere.
Mm.
They were argued in, and they weren't just argued in by workers striking. They were also argued in by university graduates 100 years ago, saying that they thought that this would work better, and the Agricultural Pay Board was because, again, Seaborne Rowntree's son in 1913 produced a study of poverty in rural areas and found the very worst poverty in this country was actually in places like rural Oxfordshire, which is why we got pay boards to improve it. It's happened before, it's just such a long time ago that we progressively made things better decade after decade after decade. That for most of my life, they've got progressively worse decade after decade. But I'm enthusiastic because I've seen more good things happen in the last 5 and 10 years than I've seen in the I was unlucky, I was 11 years old in 1979, so it wasn't great.
We're coming close to the end, so if we can just have one more question, maybe? Or two? Yeah.
Perhaps we thank Claire and Henry for putting this event on. It's been absolutely great. And all the hard work that the whole of the Living Wage campaign here in Oxford have done to get the university. They've worked so hard. I have two kind of broad questions about the campaign. Firstly, how is the proposed TTIP going to affect whether the employers can use the living wage? And secondly, is it appropriate for the living wage campaign to remain apolitical?
On TTIP, I don't know. I can definitely ask some partners and get back to you if I take your details at the end. Nothing's come up to my knowledge, but I will definitely keep an eye and let you know. In terms of remaining apolitical, we try to keep good relationships with all parties as part of our community organising traditions, which is the kind of the roots that, as I said, we come from. The idea is that you are pragmatic and you achieve the change that you can achieve now, which means not going into the wilderness for 5 years, but trying to get people pay rises now. So obviously 70,000 people affected by the pay rise yesterday, and you know, hopefully with all the work you're going to be doing, we'll double that next year just in Oxford. And I think there are good people who are against working poverty in all parties. There is really great cross-party support around this. I think with the discourse around tax credits and around working families and the promises that have been made to the electorate, we're in a really good place to win some more things at a statutory level. I think we're in a good place to win some more things in terms of some money back for living wage employers. I think we'll definitely see change in social care. We were talking a little bit about childcare earlier. I think there's a lot to be won now rather than disappearing. Also, we're a charity, so we'd lose our charitable status and we're bound by the Lobbying Act.
If I could just add, apolitical does work. Winston Churchill, before he ratted, he was a liberal at the time, was one of the people who helped bring wage councils in. I sit on the National Council for the second largest association for councils in the United Kingdom. It's 254 councils. We have 7 different political groups, and they all accept the case for the living wage. If I could perhaps end on a very happy note, Oxford City Council has won 2 successive awards, the MJ Council of the Year 2014. So this is a huge national accolade, saying you're the best council in the country. And then in September this year, we were the Association for Public Service Excellence Overall Council of the Year 2015. And we were also given IIP, Investor in People, status of gold. And only 6% of all organisations get that. And the inspectors from the IIP awards body said they have never come across such an organisation with enthusiastic employees. If you treat people decently, pay them decently, ensure they've got guaranteed hours. My motion through council was predicted by the head of HR, and he quickly went round, and anyone who was on a 0 hours contract suddenly got guaranteed hours before I put the motion to full council. But the staff know that we're trying to pull in their direction. They have been guaranteed annual inflation rises where the rest of the public sector have been told no. So not only have we moved away from the national rates of the real living wage, we've moved away from the national terms and conditions for public servants because they weren't good enough. And as a result, we've been winning awards after awards after awards because the productivity is getting better and better. You treat your staff decently and they give you loyalty.
Thank you. And one last question. Is that covered?
Kind of. Well, I was just going to say that, so it's quite negative then,
whatever you say now is going to seem nice.
It's just fairly concerning, when you spoke a bit about the government's kind of ideal whistle on, before. And to kind of hear the words giving ways used to justify that. Do you think that maybe a kind of change of terminology or a criticism might work, or would you just leave your status?
Well, that's a big question that goes to the core of where the living wage movement is at right now. I'm going to answer as a person rather than a Living Wage Foundation representative, if that's okay. I think that it is totally conceivable that we could have had the last budget that we've had without a pay rise for 6 million people. I think that is absolutely something that could have happened. And I think that this movement, among lots of other partners, has created a climate in which working pay is revealed. There are still lots of misconceptions about poverty. But we're starting to kind of shine a light on, when we say benefits, we don't necessarily mean people who are unemployed. When we say poverty, we don't mean people who are on the streets who are unemployed. We mean people, you know, who are, to use their terms, striving. I think there's definitely a piece of work around the branding and clarifying. We're starting to use voluntary living wage, enhanced minimum wage statutory. It would be really fantastic to get all of your thoughts about that. You're, you know, really important stakeholders for us, and we want to make sure that any changes that are made take everyone's views into account. But yeah, I think, you know, this is a movement. You know, the words living wage aren't ours. They have traditions in all sorts of scripture, different faith cultures, hundreds of years of union activity. In 1500 and something, there's a letter from the Pope to the world which calls for a living wage. And this is just the modern incarnation of this movement. But in the last 15 years, this is the biggest policy shift, it's the biggest change, and I think the biggest win that we've had. But winning doesn't always look exactly like you think it will.
Yeah. There are all the worries, and we know that many people's lives are going to be made much worse in the next couple of years, particularly people who've got young children are going to find that they've got a lot less money. But it still looks to me like the possibilities of the beginning of that shift, if it happens in that party, even though they're trying to take away lots of money in other ways, it's similar to when the Conservative Party tried to outbid Labour to build more council houses in the 50s. You'd have never predicted that 30 years earlier, and you wouldn't certainly have seen it 30 years later when they were doing Right to Buy. But it is possible to have the pendulum swing. It does swing every so often, and it's possibly swinging now. I think we give, just like we give academics too much credit for being too clever, because they're very good at pretending they're clever and dressing up to look as if they're clever. I think we give politicians too much credit to saying that they're too devious and cunning. You know, that little boy who didn't do very well in his history degree at the age of 21 and has never had a real job is not that different from the little boy who didn't do well at his history degree and has never had a real job. He's not the Sven Gali that he's painted as, but he's been persuaded to do this particular thing by advisers, and he's done it, and I would welcome it, and then try to work out how can you help keep pushing it in this direction, because it's happened in other countries near us and it happened in our country before, and it only won't happen if we get too lethargic and complacent or simply accept a small move as being good enough. It's great to get a start of it, but we need more, because if you're ever going to get yourselves decently housed, and if any of your children are not going to have the piss ripped out of them for how much they get paid in 25 years' time, if you don't make it a better society, then it's not going to be great in the future. That's what it's really all about, and this is one part of changing that.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to draw it to a close. We've gone a bit over our time. But I'd like to thank Danny, Emma and Van for coming, and all of you for coming as well, and give them a round of applause.